right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. We have a special treat for you today. But I want to tell you, here in upstate New York, it is now 40 degrees. So we've broken that important mark above 30-something. And I now have a lake in my backyard. And it's starting to rain. So it should be good, though, because I can see lawn everywhere. This is a huge, huge move forward in the defrosting of upstate New York and the Northeast. Okay, now, without further ado, we have a special guest for us today. It was pretty awesome because I found out 10 minutes ago, and those are the most favorite mornings of all. Our guest today is Mr. Brandon Turberville. Good morning, Brandon.
Hey, Jules, thanks for having me on at the last minute.
No, that's great. You're welcome anytime. So,
congratulations on the melting snow. It's 75 degrees here yesterday. I can't imagine what having to see melt snow would be like, but congratulations.
Well, thanks. This is like the endless deep freeze up here. I mean, literally, and it's supposed to get down in the 20s again. I don't know if you saw the weather, but there's another big deep freeze coming. And the whole Northeast is going to be plunged into freezing cold temperatures again.
That's awful.
But I'm done. So, hey, we've been watching, like, all this crazy stuff transpire between Russia and Syria, Iran, Israel. Wasn't Netanyahu's election here last night or today?
Yeah, it was coming up. I haven't actually followed the Netanyahu election as much as I should have. I was going to say I think the latest headlines was that Putin had disappeared, right?
Yes,
that Putin
yes.
Putin had been neutralized, that he had been a victim of a coup, that he was in the hospital. Apparently, you have to go to the hospital for 9 days with your girlfriend's baby or something. You know, all of these things were reported in the media. So now is the time to remember. Now that Putin has resurfaced on his normal schedule, because he didn't deviate from the schedule, he saw the president of Kyrgyzstan yesterday on his normal appointment schedule. And
wait, he was 2 hours late. I read though.
Oh well, I guess he was a victim of a coup then.
Yeah, well, I think they had to like just play on some of the you know, the insecurities everywhere. They're like, ha ha, he doesn't show up. Let's get the rumors. But, you know, I do want to make one known. I've seen quite a bit about his girlfriend and her potentially giving birth or whatever. I had a very difficult pregnancy, and I spent 9 days in the hospital giving birth between the induction and all the problems and then the infection and everything and the sicknesses that I had afterward. I was in there for 9 days. So it is possible.
Yeah, for the mother, but not the president of Russia, I would imagine.
Well, but if she was in really bad shape, I mean, my family all stayed there. They thought I was going to die.
Yeah, true. I mean, that is, you know, it's believable. It's certainly more believable than the fact that it was a coup or that he had been assassinated or any of these other ridiculous things. I mean, right. if you look at the media here versus the media in Russia, you could see how this was totally blown out of proportion. It was pretty obvious that it was just, you know, Western propaganda to begin with. In Russia, they're not really interested in it. The very few headlines about it. Nobody's really talking about where the president is for 9 days. Especially again, this was on his normal schedule. He canceled one meeting, and that was it. And all of this gets blown way out of proportion. But like I said, now is the time to remember when the Western media told us that he was the victim of a coup only a few days ago. So how these guys have any shred of credibility left is beyond me.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was Putin messing with us personally. But did you see all these military drills going on now?
The Russian or the American?
The Russian and Venezuelan, mind you.
Yeah, the Venezuelan military drills were pretty massive in scope, and the Russian drills were massive as well. It took a part of the entire country, I think, the eastern part of the country, the western part, the central areas. I think Kaliningrad was involved, the areas in the border with Finland were involved in those drills. And then the fact that Venezuela has military drills at the same time as the Russians, that should tell you a little bit about where those alliances lay. Now, that should have been obvious, though, after they've been a victim of U.S. meddling for, God, for 20 years at least. So that, you know, that should tell you. And this comes on the heels of constant Western military drills as well. You know, there's been drills inside Ukraine on the western side of Ukraine. There's been drills in Eastern Europe with the Western military. So this is all a show of force and all kind of probing and prodding and preparing for something that I hope we don't have to deal with.
Well, one of the things I saw was that I thought Obama just inked some new sanctions against Venezuela. And there was something else about the drills that were that caught my attention.
Yeah, he had just signed imposed new sanctions against Venezuela under the guise of the Venezuelan crackdown, or I guess what he would call crimes against humanity. And you know, some of that probably is true, but the United States sanctioning anybody for crimes against humanity
I
is
know.
ironic.
And I was seeing too, a story came out the other day. You'd done quite a number of stories on biometrics in the past. I mention you every time we talk about it, but I saw that Maduro, we listened to that clip last week. Maduro now has a new whole fingerprint scanning network that he's using for people to acquire groceries. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was going to be a conspiracy theory, though. I thought nobody was ever going to have to fingerprint to get groceries. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that is nuts.
But yeah, it's part of this whole this economic situation that Venezuela is facing. So they're imposing a type of rationing, and in order to get the food, you're going to have a biometric card, which I believe has your fingerprint, and you're going to have to essentially be fingerprinted in order to get food. So there you go. That's the direction that we're moving in. That's happening in Venezuela, and it also shows you how having a knee-jerk reaction to, pretend that just because the U.S. is bad, that Venezuela automatically has to be the second coming of Christ or something, and that Maduro happens to be a champion of the people. I don't think that's a good idea either.
No. Oh, I know the other thing that I saw. So, I guess was it 11 or 13 EU nations all had pledged lethal and non-lethal support to Poroshenko? Did you see that? 11. It was 11 of them.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. They've been providing. This is something that, I mean, they've been providing this weaponry for some time. This is not, anything new. The United States has been providing lethal weaponry to Poroshenko, or Pornoshenko, as some people call him, for some time, because there has been shelling, and by the way, it's intentional shelling of civilian areas. These guys, the Poroshenko forces, the Kiev government forces, are intentionally shelling civilian areas. They're shelling, diners and coffee shops and areas like that where there's no troops stationed, where there's no separatists stationed at. And they're intentionally killing civilians here. This has been documented on video footage and news organizations out of Eastern Europe and Russia as well. But you can actually see that they have their bombing coordinates that are, coordinated to hit civilian areas and hit restaurants and those types of things. And a lot of these areas are being hit with shells that have been provided by the United States, because they've got U.S.-made markings on them. And of course, we also have video footage of American, I guess, at least contractors. I don't know if you could call them American soldiers or not, because that's a little unclear. But at the very least, they're contractors who are working on the ground
Well,
inside of Ukraine.
weren't we sending ground advice, quote unquote? We were going to send advisors.
Yeah, advisors.
Yeah,
We
just like we did in
always.
Iraq, right? That boots on the ground.
Yeah, everybody should realize now. I mean, well, at one point they did realize, but I guess starting with Vietnam, anytime the United States sent advisors, that was a precursor to actual direct combat troops on the ground. And that's the way it's always been, and that's apparently the way it always will be, because once you start doing that, that's a slippery slope. And we all know that that's a slippery slope they intend to slide down. But they've got the The contractors on the ground. You can see this video of a combat situation. I think I don't know if she's Russian or Ukrainian, but she's a reporter. She runs up to the combat soldiers to ask them what was happening, to get their opinion on it. So she asks in Russian, and it's for a Russian broadcast. And the soldier turns around and says, "Get out of my face, please. Get out of my face." In English, perfect English, no accent or anything. So the guy's an American. And you could see this. I put this in my articles on a number of occasions as examples that you've actually got American soldiers or at least American contractors on the ground operating inside Western Ukraine. On the other hand, again, I guide people against knee-jerk reactions that the Russians are clearly backing the Eastern separatists, and the Russians clearly do have some presence on the ground, even though they deny it. And so you've got an actual potential for American soldiers and Russian soldiers to have a direct collision inside Ukraine. You actually have, whether it's special forces, because there's evidence that special forces from both sides are involved in this as well, that you can actually have a direct collision between Russia and the United States inside Ukraine.
Well, I mean, Russia has been amassing troops for quite a long time now along that border and sending vehicles through in the name of quote unquote humanitarian aid, remember?
Yeah, well, with the humanitarian aid, that appears to have been humanitarian aid. The white trucks and so forth, that appears to actually have been humanitarian aid there. But there are other aspects of military equipment that have been coming across the border that has been a little harder to detect. And it's quite interesting because if the Western press could detect it, they would certainly have reported that at least, because they've reported things that weren't actually military aid as military aid. They've reported, they once had video footage of a truck carrying missiles and anti-aircraft missiles into Ukraine. And when it turns out, when you look at the photo, you actually see the truck heading the other way, and it's inside Russia. But they are providing military equipment. They are providing arms. They are providing actual troops, and the numbers and the amount to which they're doing this is somewhat questionable. But you can debate it. But it is happening on both sides. And of course, the United States, with its coup of Yanukovych, the United States initiated this situation. So the Russians have the moral high ground, I guess you could say, on this one.
Absolutely. And I wanted to speak about that and Northern Ukraine. So, what was his name again? The guy they deposed?
Yanukovych.
Yanukovych, yeah. Yankovic, we used to call him. He was in bed with Russia, I remember, and they were negotiating. McCain had been over there trying to get him to take IMF money and Western EU-based money. And then, of course, you had Putin pledging dollars. And at the 11th hour, remember, there were all of those protests going on. And we'd even had footage of the traditionalists in Ukraine, the, Mother Russia Ukrainians, who it was actually kind of funny because it reminded me of my family heritage, like some of the old photos I've seen, my great grandparents. It was like old school Orthodox, carrying these religious images of, Orthodox Russian church, and they're protesting in the streets. They wanted to stay on the Russian side of the fence. But here's what I don't hear a lot of people talking about. And you know me, I mean, the thing that kind of woke me up to do what I'm doing now was Fukushima. Chernobyl happened the year I graduated from high school. That affected me quite a bit, at least mentally, and my understanding of the world and nuclear disasters. So here we are. I bet most people don't realize that Chernobyl is in Ukraine, in northern Ukraine, just outside of Kiev. And Westinghouse, I kind of dug into this probably a month or two ago. Right in December, Westinghouse had been in there trying to cut deals with the Ukrainians for nuclear fuel. And one of the things with the nuclear fuel that Westinghouse has been selling is that it's that MOX fuel, the stuff that actually burns too hot, that they say was partially responsible for the Fukushima meltdown. And if you look at the technology of nuclear reactors, the byproduct of nuclear reactors are spent fuel rods and depleted uranium and stuff that you can use in nuclear, some sort of nuclear weapon, whether it be depleted uranium bombs or whatever. So don't you think that this is potentially part of, I mean, I know this is a proxy war with Syria and the end result is that everyone wants to like tackle Iran, except for, you know, Putin is trying to stop everyone from tackling Iran and Syria, but we're all about knocking those two last chess pieces over. But don't you think that control of, and I'm trying to remember how many nuclear reactors were in that complex, but I thought there was like nine. And there was a lot. And Westinghouse, there were some pretty dirty conversations, like nastiness between Ukraine and Westinghouse before they finally cut that deal. And Westinghouse is, you know, military industrial complex United States.
Yeah, well, I think that's one, you know, that's sort of a microcosm of what the plan is for Ukraine, because the plan is especially once this situation is resolved, and, you know, presumably resolved with the reunification of the East with the West and it being completely under Western domination. I'm talking about from the perspective of the West. Then the idea is to completely privatize the resources that once belonged to the Ukrainian people, right? So they're going to privatize farming, farmland. They're going to privatize the industrial sector. And of course, if there's any kind of nuclear technology or nuclear reactors or, you know, nuclear facilities that are there as well, that's going to be privatized. And of course, who do you think that's going to go into the hands of? It's going to go into the hands of big Western private military industrial complex firms or international banks. So yeah, I mean, that's one aspect of it as well.
And right next door to Russia.
Yeah, and that's what Russia just, you know, cannot tolerate, is that NATO pushing its borders right up to, you know, to its borders. And even if it doesn't become necessarily, you know, a NATO country specifically, all it has to do is have one NATO country that has signed a treaty with it. And once a NATO country goes to war and is fired upon, that brings everybody else in as well. It's a really stupid scenario. It's reminiscent of World War One. But you know, that's the way it's set up, and that's generally the idea behind this whole situation, is to get the private corporations in there to take this these resources, to put your situation, a geopolitical situation, even better in terms of your proximity to Russia, how you've got Russia sort of cut off and backed up against a corner. And again, it enriches the IMF and the private banks as well.
I'm just looking at a map. There are four active nuclear power plants currently in Ukraine. There's one, two, three, four that are unfinished. And then you have Chernobyl. And on the Chernobyl complex, it says that three of the reactors were built in post-independence Ukraine. The other 16 reactors the country inherited from the Soviet Union. So there are quite a number of nuclear reactors in Ukraine.
Yeah, and if it really becomes a full-scale battlefield, because right now the battles are localized to the Donbas region, you know, Donetsk and Lugansk and those areas, but if it becomes a battleground across the entire country, you know, these things are in danger of being hit, and if they're being in danger of being hit, what does that mean for the rest of us? I mean, we know what happened in Chernobyl. That was a large situation. Fukushima, I think people, you know, a lot of people have made a good case that that's even worse than Chernobyl. But, you know, what would happen if these nuclear facilities start being hit in Ukraine? If we have, you know, I don't know, one, two, three, seven nuclear facilities that are damaged by warfare, what does that mean for the rest of us?
Well, even beyond that, I mean, Chernobyl's dome is in horrible disrepair, and Russia has said that it really didn't have the money to fix it properly. And I know that there was a project I know they were fundraising. I don't know if they actually began the construction or not of a new dome for Chernobyl, but that's a big problem. And here's the other thing. You know, just like in Pakistan, that in my personal opinion, Pakistan is one of those countries. And I mean, we, if you haven't looked into how the nuclear program in Pakistan secretly found its way into the open, and, you know, one of those countries that never signed the non-proliferation agreement, you know, Pakistan is one of those countries that should not have nuclear weapons, right? Because it's not a very stable country. You know what I mean? So what happens when the rebels or the Taliban or whoever the boogeyman is running around there today, you know, takes control and then runs in and decides they're going to start, you know, making themselves, even if they're dirty bombs, with the nuclear fuel? And I mean, even if it's Western backed and trained, quote unquote, terrorists who have infiltrated your country, you know what I mean? And even in Northern Ukraine, I mean, most of that revolution, I've been watching that very closely. I was actually going to go see, I think we have a playlist at over 1900 videos right now on the whole Russian Ukraine thing from the very beginning when this all started, like a year or a year and a half ago. And I mean, a lot of the unrest that has been going on in Northern Ukraine was actually all backed by Western powers. And we agitated much of that.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, the whole thing was created by the West. I mean, this was, you know, you mentioned earlier the it surrounded this IMF Russia deal, right? When the IMF conditionalities were kind of coming back to haunt Ukraine again, then Yanukovych had to choose between taking money from the IMF and more austerity, and these are harsh austerity measures, or he could take money from Russia. And he opted to take money from Russia. And immediately after that, you see these the Euromaidan protest going out in the square. And the, a lot of this was just sort of, young people out in the streets who are kind of discontented, swarming adolescents is what, you know, this referred to as in the color revolution terms. But the actual strong arm of these protest movements were Nazis. They were Right Sector, Pravi Sector, and then Dmitry Yarosh and his group, and you've also got the Svoboda Party and those guys with Chani Bok, and they were open Nazis. I mean, they wear Nazi insignia. They hate ethnic Russians. They hate Jews. It's already been said they're Nazis, and I don't know how – that's not rhetorical. That's not saying that somebody's a fascist, because they are fascist, but they're also clearly Nazis. And they were the strong arm for this so-called revolution. It was Western-backed from the beginning. It was engineered from the beginning. And in order to depose Yanukovych and put in place the austerity – ghouls, the IMF, puppets like Yatsenyuk, and then Poroshenko, who's the chocolate magnate over there.
Isn't Poroshenko a billionaire as well?
Yeah, he made all the money off the chocolate factories and chocolate companies.
I didn't know that. I didn't know where he made this money from. But yeah, just what we need, another billionaire ruler.
Yeah, and of course you got Victoria Nuland, who was on the phone with, I think it was an Eastern European ambassador, and she was discussing the fact that they were going to put Yatsenyuk in power in Ukraine. This was months before it actually happened.
I remember that. Her phone call got hacked, and someone snagged the audio and played it. Yeah, that was pretty damning.
Yeah, and of course, then months later, we have the Euromaidan, and then Yatsenyuk gets put into power. I mean, unless she is the most clever, lottery player in the world, then she had some information about what was coming ahead, and that's exactly what she had. I mean, they knew this; they had planned this to begin. The European Eastern European countries generally have these networks of destabilization already built in from years and years of Western involvement, the color revolution apparatus. They've done this in Ukraine now, I think, three times in the last 15 years. 2004, they had the Orange Revolution, and then now the Euromaidan. They've also done this all over Serbia. They've done this in a number of other countries, right? The Lukashenko and God, the name of the Lukashenko, the name of the country, Belarus. That's it. I had a
Right.
momentary lapse of memory there, but Lukashenko in Belarus, they tried this with him, and he clamped down on it. And his statement was that there will be no color revolutions in Belarus, and he knew what was happening. They tried this in Russia actually a while back, and Russia managed to stop it. That was the impetus for banning groups like USAID and the National Endowment for Democracy in Russia, although they're still active under a number of different guises. And they actually somewhat much less successfully have tried that with that Boris Nemtsov assassination, which appears to be Western backed, but at least Western capitalized. But that was largely unsuccessful. I mean, Putin's got more of a higher approval rating than virtually any Russian leader in modern history, so it didn't work.
One of the things that when you mentioned Belarus, that actually happens to be the area that received the most amount of radioactive fallout from Chernobyl. I don't know if you knew that. That
No, I
whole
didn't.
Belarus region. Yeah. So here's something I wanted to ask. So what are your thoughts? I saw a couple headlines yesterday and the day before that Putin had made a comment that he was ready in 2014 to put his nuclear forces on alert to protect Crimea. Did you see anything about
I
that?
haven't seen that. What are the sources? Do you know the?
Yeah, hold on. I have the video. Press TV actually did a clip on it yesterday. If you want, hold on. We let's do this. I was just surprised at I mean, honestly, I hate to say that Putin is in the right, but you know, we keep saying that it's an occupation. And at least southern Ukraine was very Russian to begin with. Ukraine had been a Russian nation before the fall of the Iron Curtain. That is the Soviet Union's seaport, if I am not mistaken, right? That's where they have
So,
all their navy bases down there.
yeah, it's a
And
warm water port.
right. I mean, it opens into the Black Sea, isn't it? Isn't that what's down there? Yeah. So it's been very important for Russia. And I thought that there was an agreement once Ukraine spun off to their own country, that that was kind of like a joint base. And those people, just like in any military town here in the United States, you know, military towns typically do pretty well economically because of all the commerce that goes on. So I don't think the Crimeans were really too into going with the northern Ukrainians in this revolution at all.
Well, no, historically, Crimea has always been part of Russia. They're very Russian in terms of their culture. And again, the U.S. was calling Russian involvement in Crimea an occupation early on. Remember, they were saying that Russia has put troops into Crimea. Well, Russia already had a base in Crimea.
Right.
And well, of course, the troops are going to be on the base. That's like saying the United States is occupying Germany because it has troops in its military bases in Germany. And if there was a situation on the borders of Germany or inside Germany, the United States would obviously activate their troops to be on to be ready. And that's what Russia did. And then in the Western media, of course, that came out as the new Hitler, Russia's taking over Crimea by force. And there was a referendum. The Crimeans voted overwhelmingly to join Russia. That seems to be a legitimate vote, and it's done. And
And
the United
actually, 1 year anniversary was yesterday.
Yeah, and the United States can throw a fit and say they don't recognize it all they want, but that doesn't really matter. The world doesn't bend to the twisted reality that the United States tends to think it should. I mean, it's funny, the United States put sanctions on Iran, they put sanctions on Syria, they've got sanctions on North Korea, they've got sanctions on Russia, now more sanctions on Venezuela. If we just keep going the way we're going, eventually the United States will sanction everybody and we'll end free trade. So,
Right, and China's going to get all the business.
yeah, we'll do that except for China, and then we'll
Right.
just.
Well, China's just eating it up. They're like, hey, we'll sell you stuff.
So it's every week you hear more and more about sanctions, and not to go too far off topic, I just wanted to throw this out. It's kind of funny, but this little this moron, this robot that was purchased by Benjamin Netanyahu and his AIPAC group, this Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas,
Oh no.
he recently went on Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer, and told Bob Schieffer that he was describing how aggressive Iran was in the Middle East, and he starts going on this rant and saying, well, we have to stop them because they're driving for regional dominance, and they already control Tehran, and they control Damascus and Beirut and Baghdad, and it's Tehran is the capital of Iran.
I think you posted something about that. I actually saw that. And how long has Tehran been the capital and Iran been in that geographical area?
Oh, for years and years and years and years before this little dweeb was ever born, this was it was just hilarious. And it's not so much the fact that that such a little drone would say something like that with a straight face. It's that nobody really called him on it. I guess a couple of independent media outlets did, but he says this with a straight face. Bob Schieffer doesn't say, "Well, wait a minute, Tehran is the capital of Iran." No, he just goes on as if this is evidence that Iran is marching across the Middle East. Yeah, most countries do control their capitals, and so that's just a funny aside to foreign policy in the United States. Once you get out of the United States, you realize how this place really is crazy town in a lot of aspects.
It sure is. Speaking of Crazy Town, what do you think of Netanyahu coming to visit Congress on his own?
Oh, it's disgraceful. It
And
it's
then this
disgraceful.
letter writing campaign to Iran by these 47 legislators, circumventing. When I really started to look at what they did, I was like, wow, don't we look dumb? And we don't even understand our own laws.
Oh, we look incredibly dumb, but that's what's so funny is that 47. What's the percentage of 47 members of Congress? Is that close to a third? I don't know. It's a decent percentage of Congress, but of the Senate, and these guys essentially violated the Logan Act, and this is a pretty big deal. This is the idea that you can't have, you can't have connections or contact with other members of foreign governments in order to decide policy outside of the normal, realms of chain of command. In other words, if the president is, and I say this with a staunch hatred of Obama, but when the president is trying to negotiate some type of deal, which is unfair at the basis because Iran shouldn't have to make a deal with the United States over their nuclear program, but this is, the way it's going. The president is trying to set up a deal with Iran, and then the Senate comes in and says, "Don't you do it, because if you do it and it's not all that we want, we'll just tear it up and disobey it anyway." That's a violation of the Logan Act, and it's pretty clear that's a violation of the Logan Act. 47 senators took part in this, and one of them, of course, was Rand Paul, Mr. Constitution,
I
right? You
just
should have
heard
known this.
Tarpley talking about that. Yeah, I didn't know Rand Paul was a signatory to that.
Yeah, Rand Paul's hawkish on Iran. Rand Paul's scared to death that Iran's going to have a nuclear program, which apparently means a nuclear bomb, despite the fact that virtually every intelligence analysis has shown that they don't have the ability to get a nuclear bomb, and it would be years and years and years for them to even have the capability to produce one if they wanted to. That all the evidence is that they want this for a civilian purpose, for energy purposes. Of course, if I was Iran, I'd want a nuclear bomb as quickly as I could
I
get it.
said
But
that too. You know, even when Rouhani was coming out being like all kind of cool about the situation, saying, yeah, we'll negotiate, right? Ahmadinejad was he was kind of ornery and like to just poke the United States with a stick. But Rahuani came out and he's like, well, yeah, well, we're going to sit down and have talks. And I was thinking to myself, if I were Iran, though, that's exactly what I'd be doing. I'd be playing all nice, but in the background, I'd be thinking, screw you guys. I'm going to make sure. I mean, they see the writing on the wall. They're one of the last pieces that hasn't been knocked over yet.
Yeah, and they know that, and that's you know, that's the other thing too, is it's the diplomatic school of is that you always negotiate, because if you negotiate, maybe you can buy yourself a little time, and you always get to know a little more about the other side. All of this stuff with the Iranian program, though, by the way, I look at as theater, because I don't believe for a second that Obama wants a nuclear deal with Iran. That this is a situation where they can bring Iran to the table. They can give Iran a list of demands. They can have some theater going on with these idiot senators who write this AIPAC-funded letter. And Iran can, you know, if Iran backs out of the deal, or if they refuse to take part in the deal, we give the U.S. the ability to say, well, we tried. We tried diplomacy, and it didn't work. And
right,
now we have to take other means.
Exactly. And we can give them an ultimatum. Right now, it's just kind of pie in the sky. Well, you know, Iran didn't do this, or they didn't let these inspectors in and whatever. But once there's something inked, I definitely think that this is their ploy to not only get their foot in the door, but to give them some sort of global... Oh, it's early. What's the word I'm looking for? Verification, where they can go in and not have the world scream at them like Iran wasn't doing anything. They can point to a piece of paper and say, well, look, they agreed to these terms and they broke them. Like Russia going in there and selling Iran nuclear power plants. I mean, that deal was just inked, what, a month ago?
Yeah.
There were six of them, I think, or nine. I don't remember.
Or they can make the agreement so, you know, so egregious to the Iranians, right? In order to capitulate to these 47 lunatics, they have to put in, you know, some type of terminology that makes the agreement so odious to the Iranians that they say, no, we're not going to sign that. And then that's your ticket. That's your ticket to say, you know, again, the Iranians will not cooperate, and we right. have to do something about that. Remember, Netanyahu also recently stated that, basically, if the United States doesn't do something about the Iranians, then Israel will do something and basically drag us in.
I saw that. And he's been trying. I mean, you were the person who really got me to pay a lot of attention to starting with the whole Syria situation, but how this has really spun out. I mean, it's Syria, Ukraine, and Iran, and they're all part of the same big puzzle. Iran, of course, is the cherry on top that we're going for. But, you know, Netanyahu has been pushing for this since day one, threatening that if, you know, we don't back him, he's going in. And how funny, I just looked, it looks like election day is today. And Netanyahu was out there crying last week that, you know, we and the world were setting him up for a loss. What's going to happen if he loses?
Well, we can only hope. I haven't actually followed the internal, affairs of the Israeli political machine as much as I should have. And I just noticed when you did that the election was today. So we'll see how that turns out. But he's discredited himself a number of times over the last 20 years. You can go back and look at video footage of him speaking to Congress repeatedly, telling people that Iran was only a year away or 2 years away, maybe even three, I think, giving him a pretty wide estimate there, 3 years away from a nuclear bomb in 1996, and then 3 years away from a nuclear bomb in 2001, and then 3 years away from a nuclear bomb in 2006. And it just keeps going on and on and on that Iran is 3 years away from a nuclear bomb. And that's what he's saying today. And it's, you know, it's interesting, this question of whether or not Iran can have a nuclear bomb. They have signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel has not.
Right.
Iran does not have a nuclear bomb. Israel does. Iran has not acted aggressively in years. I won't say that they've ever done it, but they haven't acted. They haven't expressed aggression in the Middle East in years. Israel did that couple of weeks ago. So Who do you really consider the madman here? And when Tom Cotton states that Iran is in control of Damascus and Beirut, that's bull. What Damascus is doing, I mean, what Tehran and Iran are doing, they are involved in Lebanon, they are involved in Syria, and they are involved in Iraq. They're fighting ISIS.
Right.
You know, they're doing what the Americans claim we're doing, what we're funding them, but the Iranians are actually fighting ISIS on the ground, and that's part of the reason that there's been such a turn of events in Syria and Iraq.
Well, also, and now, Iran is on the ground helping us, and Netanyahu comes out and says, the enemy of our enemy is our enemy. Which that is not the way that that statement goes, but he's calling out now how dangerous Iran is, that they are helping us with ISIS, and that we shouldn't be trusting them in Damascus. Isn't Iran has their Iranian National Guard, I believe, right? Aren't they helping out? Isn't Hezbollah is an organization that is composed of Iranian support and Syrian support, I believe, right? Who's supporting that?
Hezbollah is the Lebanese sort of revolutionary wing of the Lebanese. They are not capitulating to Israel or to the United States. They are sort of a military wing. They're a very effective fighting force. If you remember several years ago when Israel invaded Lebanon, the reason Israel got sent packing is because Hezbollah sent them packing. It wasn't necessarily the Lebanese army proper. There is a difference between Hezbollah and the Lebanese army proper. And Hezbollah does receive some support from Iran and Syria.
And Hezbollah was recognized as a political entity, I believe, not too long ago. But then we turned around and said, no, they're a terrorist organization.
Right, because they don't support Israel because they fight
Right.
against Israel. And this is, Hezbollah and Iran's forces have been involved in Syria, and again, they're fighting the ISIS terrorists that the West has backed to fight there. So no wonder Iran is considered extremist and Hezbollah is considered terrorist. Hezbollah is not a terrorist organization in reality, in the
Right.
world of Benjamin Netanyahu and Fox News and CNN and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it is, but in reality, it's not.
I just saw too that Iran is delivering their first batch of Ghadir, Ghadir, Ghadir missiles to their naval forces. So I don't know what that means, but they're loading up their ships. I know you were saying that it's been quite a number of years since Iran has shown any aggression, but Iran has the support of not only Russia, but China as well, right? We had this whole, I mean, if we rewind to the days of knocking Libya off the board and Gaddafi wanting to start trading in dinars for oil. That was right around the same time that Iran cut a deal with Russia and China, was it not?
Yeah, right around the same time. And again, Iran is from what I can tell, not gearing up for any aggressive military action. They're gearing up to defend themselves because they
Right.
see the writing on the wall. They know what's coming in their direction. The recent statements by Kerry, for instance, I'll mention this. John Kerry recently stated that it may be necessary for us to negotiate with Assad. That was the headlines over the Western media, right? John Kerry, we must negotiate with Assad. So most people who only read headlines think, oh, well, Kerry is coming around, right? He's finally realized that we should stop this insanity. We should negotiate with Assad and end this. Well, that's not what he's saying. What John Kerry is saying is that we should negotiate with Bashar al-Assad for a transition out of power. Read that statement. He says for a transition out of power. So in other words, the statement was 4 years ago, Assad must go, and today in 2015, the statement is Assad must go. So they're not done with Syria, and Iran realizes this. John Kerry stated 2 weeks ago that military action, direct military action, U.S. bombing against Syrian forces. presumably, would be a possibility that we needed to look at that in terms of a way that we could make Assad cede power. So we're not out of the woods by any means. This appears to be one of those things that just lulls people to sleep and say, oh well, they're backing down now. Nothing's gonna happen. It's all on the upswing for the Syrian military. But I wouldn't believe this the way these things are being reported at all.
Too, one of the things that I remember is that in the very beginning, when of course we had to start bombing over the Syrian border because we were chasing ISIS. Remember that? Like we started lobbing bombs into Syrian airspace, but Israel had been doing that for a long time, right? I was reading that they actually sent bombs in like a basketball. From Israel, that's how they'd shoot them in. So they'd go way up and then come down. But once we started chasing ISIS over the border, we, of course, now had engaged in direct conflict in Syria. But, it was under the guise that we were chasing ISIS. It wasn't going after Assad per se, because that was something that is kind of the red button issue between us and Russia. But not too long ago, maybe a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, when Obama was being pushed on what his strategy in Syria was, didn't they come out and in the beginning he's like, well, we're chasing ISIS and that's why we're in there. But then it comes out and they're like, well, and part of, I think it was the spokesperson, the White House, whoever it is now, they've had such a revolving door, but they came out and said that yes, and the strategy includes removing Assad. Now, I thought that was taken off the table 4 years ago.
Well, no, they never took it off the table. The idea was being presented as we have to get rid of ISIS first. So we're concerned about Assad and we want Assad out, but we want to get rid of ISIS first. That's the way it was presented. But I think it's important to point out that the United States is not chasing ISIS. The United States is funding it, and the
Oh,
United
wow,
States has
right.
not been bombing ISIS. They've been bombing Syrian infrastructure, and a couple of ISIS fighters have been killed in the process. And in some cases, where ISIS fighters are getting off the reservation and maybe taking over strategic oil refineries that are owned by international corporations, then they do get bombed. But when they're taking over other areas, then it's nothing but I refer to it as death squad herding. In other words, driving them back from one area to another that's more strategic, like Kobani or Ain al-Arab. The ISIS fighters aren't in really that much danger from American airstrikes so long as they stay on the reservation. The United States is bombing Syrian infrastructure, and notice also that they said the so-called moderate rebels were going to be given authority to call in airstrikes. Now we've talked about this before. There's no such thing as a moderate rebel in Syria. If there's a moderate rebel in Syria, I want to see him so I could base my research off of him, because he's probably the only one there. Nobody's ever seen a moderate rebel in Syria. He doesn't exist. They're all Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, ISIS fighters. They're all part of this Western-backed fanatic fundamentalist fringe. Destabilization force. So they're going to give moderate rebels, i.e., al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, the opportunity to call in U.S. airstrikes. So now we are officially going to be al-Qaeda's air force in the Middle East. And who do you think they're going to call in airstrikes against? ISIS?
Yeah, right.
No. They're going to call them in against the Syrian military, and you're going to have the United States doing just what I said it was going to do when I started writing about this, the airstrike issue a couple of years ago, which is bombing Assad's military. And they're going to say that, it was either a mistake. We didn't mean to bomb Assad's military. Oops, we just blew up a military base. And Assad's going to be faced with the question of, do I respond now and risk direct military conflict with the U.S., or do I try to gloss over it and try to survive and just get killed by a death of a thousand cuts? So, that's I think what we're seeing in Syria, and in these U.S. airstrikes, these are a fraud. Remember, the so-called moderate rebels, Harakat Hazam, this was a group that the U.S. was giving TOW anti-tank missiles to. They were giving heavy arms, because they were moderates. Well, Harakat Hazam, I wrote several months ago how they allegedly got into a battle with ISIS fighters and gave up their weapons without a fight. They just put the weapons down and walked away, right? And I said at the time, that is not a battle. What that is funneling weapons to ISIS through this supposedly moderate group and then painting it in terms of a narrative in the Western press. Well, just recently, Harakat Hazam has pledged allegiance to ISIS openly. So it's official that they're members of ISIS. So what did we do? We gave weapons to ISIS.
I think Boko Haram did too.
Oh yeah, Boko Haram. That's another thing. Boko Haram is nothing but the same, a different wing, the Nigerian wing of the same organization. It's not new. The Boko Haram just, I think, pledged allegiance to ISIS, and ISIS has been giving them some, moral support and other types of support, advice, and all that kind of stuff. But over the last 2 years, ISIS has been praising Boko Haram repeatedly for the things that they've been doing on social media and that type of thing. So the connection between ISIS and Boko Haram has been there from the beginning, and they're doing the same thing. Notice that where Boko Haram is taking over in northeastern Nigeria, this is an area where there's going to be a rail hub that's being built by the Chinese. So what you're seeing is geopolitics. The U.S. is funding these terrorists to take over an area to block out the Chinese from this particular area of Africa.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the proxy war in Africa between China and the US. You know, just so you know, anytime I mention ISIS, there are always quotes around it. Because I know this is so dirty. And I mean, not only you were saying about the forces that like dropped all their weapons and ran, but how many moderate rebel weapons drops have we had, quote unquote, moderate rebel weapons drops have we had that have ended up in the hands of, oops, ISIS? And remember, they actually videoed some of it. There was a couple months back, they had videoed getting their hands on some of our shipments and made jokes about it online. I mean, the whole thing is just so comical if it wasn't sad, but absolutely. I mean, this is Hillary Clinton came out quite a number of years ago and had admitted that we had fully trained the Mujahideen and that Al-Qaeda and all of this was our creation to help destabilize the Middle East. So how has anything changed? It hasn't. It's all the same groups of people.
Yeah, and again, Hillary, who should never be president, by the way,
No.
Hillary mentioned that we created the Mujahideen, but you can actually go back and watch video of Zbigniew Brzezinski speaking to the Mujahideen and telling them that this is a holy war, this is your war, this is a jihad. Zbigniew Brzezinski admitted in an interview that they didn't create the Mujahideen to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. They created the Mujahideen to draw the Russians in. So it was created before the Russians went in. And this is a long tradition, right? This was a Muslim Brotherhood was created way back when in the early 1900s by the British intelligence agencies to combat Arab nationalism. Lawrence of Arabia used a color revolution apparatus on the method of Mazzini, Young Turks, young Arab societies, and that sort of thing, to do the same thing, to break up the Middle East for geopolitical purposes. So this is nothing new. It may be new to some people, but this is really just the same old method being put into place with a little more technology and a little more effective mainstream media propaganda.
Now, let me ask you, speaking of the Muslim Brotherhood, so I see there was the great number of Morsi supporters, and I don't remember the number, but I thought it was over like 500 of them. There was a very large number. Once Morsi was knocked out of power, they all were arrested, and I saw that they were all sentenced to death, and just recently one of them was killed now. But I didn't realize that that was an MI6 creation. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it was created early on in the Arabian areas to combat what was known as the Waft Party, right? The British had invaded the Arabian countries that were not necessarily, set up in terms of their borders the way they are today, but Arabia, I guess we'll call it. The British had invaded, And there was an Arab nationalism growing. They wanted the British out, naturally. And the British came in and said, no, we'll create a group. We call it the Muslim Brotherhood. And the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood is we don't really care if the British are here or not. We just want a caliphate. The British can stay. They're our concern. We just want a caliphate based on, Sharia law or, this kind of garbage. So the Muslim Brotherhood was able to fight the Waft Party, right? It was able to fight them physically. It was able to fight them politically. Of course, with all the support it had from the British, it won out. So it was an effort to break the backs of the Arab resistance to the British, and that's what the Muslim Brotherhood was. It was created by the British intelligence agencies, and the British intelligence never relinquished control. Obviously, they've continued to control the Muslim Brotherhood, and now U.S. intelligence agencies, which are essentially the same as the British, are involved in controlling them as well. They were one of the main fighting forces in Syria early on, was
Well,
the Muslim
right. They
Brotherhood.
tried to make Morsi take the tanks across the border to Syria, and that was when the general took control, and the Muslim Brotherhood is out now. But I didn't realize about the caliphate. So is that why they're out? Because they said you guys had more than enough time to create a caliphate. You lost. Now ISIS is in. ISIS is going to create the caliphate in Iraq. I mean,
Well,
that's what they're working on now, right?
it's all part of the same organization. It's all part of the same, ISIS, Al Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood. It's all part of the same wing. But what you get with the Muslim Brotherhood is you have a more formidable political force, whereas you can get guys in suits and ties to get up
Right.
and wine and dine at restaurants and be doctors and lawyers and, petty bourgeoisie kind of guys that can go out and appear to be somewhat more professional, whereas ISIS, you've got a bunch of apes and monkeys hopping around and chopping people's heads off. But they're
With
all part of the
special effects, or are they really doing that?
I'm sure. But these guys are all part of the same Western intelligence organization, Western intelligence apparatus, I should say. In
Hey, I
Egypt,
hate. Oh, go ahead. I was going
no,
to
go ahead.
say, I hate to do this, but we got like 15 seconds left. If
Oh,
you can
okay.
even believe it. I know 1 hour is really short. Brandon, you have an awesome Tuesday. I hope it's 75 degrees and sunny there again today. I guess we'll catch up with you later. The show is over. I can't even believe it. Thank you so much for being on today. I wish we had 2 hours because I had a lot more to talk about. Well, you're welcome anytime. Please let me know anytime you're off and you want to come on and talk because it's always a treat for everybody. All right, guys, have a happy Tuesday. Kevin Blanche is up next, and we will catch up with you tomorrow. Take care. We'll be right back.